After dinner, as they were talking by the fireplace, everything vanished, and the old table came back with the untouched dishes on it. But, oddly enough, no one was hungry any longer, so that nobody wanted to have supper after such a magnificent dinner, which shows that the dishes which had been substituted for the original ones were real and not imaginary. This persecution had been going on for several months. The lady consulted the blessed Bernardino of Felter, whose body is the object of veneration in St. James Church, some distance outside the city walls. And at the same time, she vowed to wear for a whole year a grey monk's gown, with a rope as a belt, like those used by the Minor Brothers in the order to which Bernardino belonged. She hoped, through his intercession, that she would be freed from the persecutions of the incubus. Indeed, on September 28th, which is the vigil of the dedication of Archangel Saint Michael and the feast of the Blessed Bernardino, she took the votive dress. The next morning was the feast of St. Michael. Our afflicted lady went to the church of that saint, which was, as I have said, her own parish. It was about 10 o'clock, and a very large crowd was going to mass. Now, the poor woman had no sooner put her foot on the church ground than all of a sudden her vestments and ornaments fell to the ground and were carried away by the wind, leaving her as naked as the hand. Very fortunately, it so happened that among the crowd were two knights of mature age who saw the thing and hurriedly removed their coats, to hide as well as they could that woman's nudity. And having put her in a coach, they drove her home. As for the vestments and jewels stolen by the incubus, he returned them 6 months later. To make a long story short, although there are many other tricks that this incubus played on her, and some amazing ones, suffice it to say that he kept tempting her for many years. But, at last, perceiving he was wasting his efforts, he discontinued these unusual and bothersome vexations. As a theologian, Fr. Sinistrari was as puzzled by such reports as most modern students of UFO lore are by the Villas-Boas case, observing that the fundamental texts of the church gave no clear opinion on such cases. Sinistrari wondered how they should be judged by religious law. A great part of his manuscript is devoted to a detailed examination of this question. The lady in the above example did not allow the incubus to have intercourse with her, but there are numerous other cases in the records of the church, especially in witch trials, in which there was intercourse. From the church's point of view, says Fr. Sinistrari, there are several problems. First, how is such intercourse physically possible? Second, how does demoniality differ from bestiality? Third, what sin is committed by those who engage in such intercourse? Fourth, what should their punishment be? The earliest author who uses the word demonialitas is J. Caramuel, in his Theologia Fundamentalis. Before him, no one made a distinction between demoniality and bestiality. All the moralists, following St. Thomas Aquinas, understood by bestiality any kind of carnal intercourse with an object of a different species. Yet, a few centuries earlier, the best minds saw in similar accounts an occasion to increase their knowledge of human nature and did not feel it was beneath their dignity as philosophers to spend considerable time in this study. If, as a 20th century scientist, I need an apology to write the present book, this should be as good a precedent as any. The act of love, writes Sinistrari, has for an object human generation. Unnatural semination, that is, intercourse that cannot be followed by generation, constitutes a separate type of sin against nature. But it is the subject of that semination that distinguishes the various sins under that type. If demoniality and bestiality were in the same category, a man who had copulated with a demon could simply tell his confessor, I have committed the sin of bestiality. And yet he obviously has not committed that sin. Considerable problems arose, however, when one had to identify the physical process of intercourse with demons. This is clearly a most difficult point, as difficult as that of identifying the physical nature of flying saucers, and Sinistrari gives a remarkable discussion of it, pointing out that the main object of the discussion is to determine the degree of punishment these sins deserve, He tries to list all the different ways in which the sin of demoniality can be committed. First he remarks, there are quite a few people, overinflated with their little knowledge, who dare deny what the wisest authors have written, and what everyday experience demonstrates, namely, that the demon, either incubus or succubus, has carnal union not only with men and women but also with animals. Sinistrari docs not deny that some young women often have visions and imagine that they have attended a sabbat. Similarly, ordinary erotic dreams have been classified by the church quite separately from the question we are studying. Sinistrari does not mean such psychological phenomena when he speaks of demoniality. He refers to actual physical intercourse, such as the basic texts on witchcraft discuss. Thus in the Compendium Maleficarum, Nuxius gives 18 case histories of witches who have had carnal contact with demons. All cases are vouched for by scholars whose testimony is above question. Besides, St. Augustine himself says in no uncertain terms, it is a widespread opinion, confirmed by direct or indirect testimony of trustworthy persons, that the Sylvans and Fauns, commonly called incubi, have often tormented women, solicited and obtained intercourse with them. There are even demons, which are called Duzes, that is, Hightons, by the Gauls, who are quite frequently using juc impure practices. This is vouched for by so numerous and so lily authorities that it would be impudent to deny it. Now, the devil makes use of two ways in these carnal contacts. One he uses with sorcerers and witches, the other with men and women perfectly foreign to witchcraft. This is a point of paramount importance. What Sinistrari is saying is that two kinds of people may come in contact with the beings he calls demons, those who have made a formal pact with them, and he gives the details of the process for making this pact, and those who simply happen to be contacted by them. The implications of this fundamental statement to occultism for the interpretation of the fairy faith and of modern UFO stories should be obvious to the reader. The devil does not have a body. Then, how does he manage to have intercourse with men and women? How can women have children from such unions if they specifically express the desire? All the theologians answer that the devil borrows the corpse of a human being, either male or female, or else he forms with other materials a new body for this purpose. Indeed, we find here the same theory as that expressed by one of the gentry and quoted by Wentz: we can make the old young, the big small, the small big. The devil then is said to proceed in one of two ways. Either he first takes the form of a female succubus and then has intercourse with a man. Or else, the succubus induces lascivious dreams in a sleeping man and makes use of the resulting pollution to allow the devil to perform the second part of the operation. This is the theory taught by Nuxius, who gives a great number of examples. Likewise, Hector Boethius, in Historia Scotorum, documents the case of a young Scot who, for several months, was visited in his bedroom, the windows and doors of which were closed, by a succubus of the most ravishing beauty. She did everything she could to obtain intercourse with him, but he did not yield to her caresses and entreaties. One point intrigued Sinistrari greatly: such demons do not obey the exorcists. They have no fear of relics and other holy objects, and thus they do not fall into the same category as the devils by which people are possessed, as the story quoted above certain shows. But then, are they really creatures of the devil? Should not we place them in a separate category, with the fairies, and the elementals they so closely resemble? And then, if such creatures have their own bodies, does the traditional theory, that incubi and succubi are demons who have borrowed human corpses, hold? Could it explain how children are born from such unions? What are the physical characters of such children? If we admit that the UFO reports we have quoted earlier in this chapter indicate the phenomenon has genetic contents, then the above questions are fundamental, and it is important to see how Sinistrari understood them. Therefore, I give in the following a complete translation of his discussion of the matter. To theologians and philosophers, it is a fact that from the copulation of humans, man or woman, with the demon, human beings are sometimes born. It is by this process that Antichrist must be born. According to a number of doctors, Bellarmine, Sayers, Maluenda, etc. Besides, they observe that as the result of a quite natural cause, the children generated in this manner by the incubi are tall, very strong, very daring, very magnificent and very wicked. Maluenda confirms what has been said above, proving by the testimony of various classical authors that it is to such unions that the following owe their birth, Romulus and Remus, according to Livy and Plutarch. Servius Tullius, 6th king of the Romans, according to Denis of Halicarnassus and Pliny. Plato the philosopher, according to Diogenes Laertius and St. Jerome. Alexander the Great, according to Plutarch and Quinticus. Seleucus, king of Syria, according to Justin and Appian. Scipio the African, according to Livy. The emperor Caesar Augustus, according to Suetonius. Aristomenes of Messenia, the illustrious Greek general, according to Strabo and Pausanias. Let us add the English Merlin or Melchion, born of an incubus and a nun, the daughter of J. Charlemagne. And finally, as writes Cocculus, quoted by Maluenda Carat Fr. Tart Lam Teresiarch, whose name is Martin Luther. However, in spite of all the respect I owe so many great doctors, I do not see how their opinion can stand examination. Indeed, as Ibrim's comment throws more light, if the body of these children is tints different from the bodies of other children, their soul will certainly have qualities that will not be common to others. That is why Cardinal Bellarmine thinks Antichrist will he horn of a woman having had intercourse with tin incubus. Parerius observes very well in commentary on Genesis, chapter 6, all the strength, all the power of the human sperm, comes from spirits that evaporate and vanish as soon as they issue from the genital cavities where they were warmly stored. The physicians agree on this. Therefore, it is not possible for the demon to keep the sperm he has received in a sufficient state of integrity to produce generation, for, no matter what the vessel where he could attempt to keep it is, this vessel would have a temperature equal to the natural temperature of human genital organs, which is found nowhere but in those same organs. Now, in a vessel where the warmth is not natural, but artificial, spirits are resolved, and no generation is possible. A second objection is that generation is a vital act through which man, from his own substance, introduces sperm through the use of natural organs, into a place proper for generation. To the contrary, in the special case we are now considering, the introduction of the sperm cannot be a vital act of the generating man, since it is not by him that it is introduced into the matrix. And, for the same reason, it cannot be said that the man to whom the sperm belonged has engendered the fetus that is procreated. Neither can we consider the incubus as the father, since the sperm is not of his own substance. Thus here is a child who is born and has no father, which is absurd. Third objection. When the father engenders naturally, there is a concourse of two causalities, a material one, for he provides the sperm that is the material of generation, and an efficient one, for he is the main agent in the generation, according to the common opinion of philosophers. But, in our case, the man who does nothing but provide the sperm simply gives material, without any action tending toward generation. Therefore he could not be regarded as the child's father. And this is contrary to the notion that the child engendered by an incubus is not his child, but the child of the man whose sperm was borrowed by the incubus. We also read in the scriptures, Genesis 6-4, that giants were born as a result of intercourse between the sons of God and the daughters of man. This is the very letter of the sacred text. Now, these giants were men of tall stature, as it is said in Baruch 3:26. And far superior to other men. Besides their monstrous size, they called attention by their strength, their plunders, their tyranny, and it is to the crimes of these giants that we must attribute the main and primary cause of the flood, according to Cornelius Alapide in his commentary on Genesis. Some state that under the name of sons of God we must understand the sons of Seth, and, under that of daughters of men, the daughters of Cain, because the former practiced piety, religion, and all other virtues, while the latter, the children of Cain, did exactly the opposite. But, with all the respect we owe Chrysostom, Cyril, and others who share this view, it will be recognized it is in disagreement with the obvious meaning of the text. What do the scriptures say? That from the conjunction of the above were born men of monstrous corporeal proportions. Therefore, these giants did not exist previously, and if their birth was the result of that union, it is not admissible to attribute it to the intercourse between the sons of Seth and the daughters of Cain who, of ordinary size themselves, could have children only of ordinary size. Consequently, if the intercourse in question has given birth to beings of monstrous proportions, we must see the not the ordinary intercourse of men with women but the operation of the incubi who, owing to their nature, can very well be called sons of God. This opinion is that of the Platonist philosophers and of François George of Venice, and it is not in contradiction with that of Josephus the historian, Philo, St. Justin Martyr, Clement of Alexandria, and Tertullian, according to whom these incubi could be angels who had allowed themselves to commit the sin of luxury with women. Indeed, as we shall show, there is nothing but a single opinion under a double appearance. What we have here is a complete theory of contact between our race and another race, non-human, different in physical nature, but biologically compatible with us. Angels, demons, fairies, creatures from heaven, hell, or Magonia, they inspire our strangest dreams, shape our destinies, steal our desires. But who are they? Chapter 5, they are fairies, he that speaks to them shall die, I'll wink and couch, no man their works must die. William Shakespeare, The Merry Wives of Windsor, they speak all the languages of the earth. They know all about the past and future of the human race, of any human being. This statement was made in 1968 by a Spanish clerk who claims he has been in contact with extraterrestrials since 1954. The inhabitants of planet Wolf 424, Sic, are among us in human form and with false identities. They are far superior to us and very peace-loving. I am in permanent contact with them. They either write to me or call me. We have meetings. How did he contact these superior entities? It seems that in 1954 a saucer threw a stone covered with hieroglyphics into the University Gardens, Madrid. Fernando Sesma copied the symbols down, and soon two-way communication began. In Great Britain also, fantastic rumors are spreading. British scientists, some people claim, have been contacted by a mysterious source through radio and have become involved in undercover activities at the request of extraterrestrials. Some of these scientists have disappeared through such contacts. So the story goes, the extraterrestrials help to control our history. For what purpose? I myself have received letters from individuals claiming to be members of secret organizations whose headquarters are, quite literally, out of this world. These correspondents informed me that the purpose of these groups is to prevent mankind from reaching other worlds in space. Of course, other contactees make exactly opposite claims. The fact remains, however, that belief in non-human control of terrestrial destinies is as old as politics. Thus a Madrid newsman, Armando Puente, claims that Sesma warned him 3 months before Robert Kennedy was assassinated that the senator would be killed. Sesma similarly predicted the wave of UFO sightings in Argentina, a much easier task. Moreover, the same power attributed to saucer people, namely, that of influencing human events, was once the exclusive property of fairies. This was true in the beliefs of ignorant medieval peasants and of the scholars as well. Thus, one of the first questions put to Joan of Arc by her inquisitors was if she had any knowledge or if she had not assisted at the assemblies held at the Fountain of the Fairies, near Domremy, around which dance malignant spirits. And another question and answer was thus recorded, asked whether she did not believe, prior to the present day, that fairies wcc malignant spirits. She answered she did not know. To pursue this line further would involve reopening the entire problem of witchcraft, which is obviously beyond the purpose of this book. It is important, however, to note the continuum of beliefs, for the continuum leads directly from primitive magic, through mystical experience, the fairy faith, and religion, to modern flying saucers. The study of witchcraft has shown these subjects to be closely interrelated, and from the point of view of modern psychiatry, they must be treated together. And while we are not concerned with individual beliefs in this chapter, we are interested in the social implications of such rumors, which have seldom been faced by the students of the phenomenon. In the Soviet Union, not so long ago, a leading plasma physicist died in strange circumstances. He was thrown under a Moscow subway train by a mentally deranged woman. It is noteworthy that she claimed a voice from space had given her orders to kill that particular man, orders she could not resist. Soviet criminologists, I have been reliably informed, are worried by the increase of such cases in recent years. Madmen rushing through the streets because they think the Martians are after them have always been commonplace. But the current wave of mental unbalance that can be specifically tied to the rise and development of the contactee myth is an aspect of the UFO problem that must be considered with special care. It was to be hoped that the recent scientific investigations of the UFO phenomenon would have treated this problem with the attention it deserved. Unfortunately, they have not done so. This leads me to offer, in the present chapter, all the information one can provide on this matter, with the hope that sociologists will tackle the problem with more than passing amusement. Of course, some details relevant to this aspect of the UFO phenomenon cannot be published. This docs not mean, however, that they should remain the exclusive property of a few bureaucrats concerned only with the preservation of their peace of mind and the stability of their administrations. To let UFO speculation grow unchecked would only make the public an easy and defenseless prey to charlatans of all kind. It would mean that any organized group bent upon the destruction of our society could undermine it by skillful use of the saucer mythology. They could take us to Magonia with the blessing of all the rationalists. A great sign in heaven. Knock is a tiny village in the west of Ireland. But something took place there on August 21, 1879. Something no student of the human mind should ignore : the weather had been growing steadily worse all day long. At 7 p.m. rain was pouring down on the village as Archdeacon Kavanagh returned home. Mary McLellan, his housekeeper, lighted a good turf fire and then, at age 307, went out to visit her friend, Mrs. Margaret Pearson. As she passed the church, she noticed several strange figures in a field and something like an altar with a white light, but she dismissed the sight from her mind and continued on her way. Rain was still falling heavily, and she was not tempted to investigate, although she did find the matter very strange. Two other parishioners had seen the figures before her and had reacted in similar fashion. Later on, when it was still not yet dark and as rain continued to fall, Mary McLellan went back past the church, accompanied by Mrs. Pearson. At one point, between the church building and the two women, lay an uncut meadow. And in the meadow on top of the grass, three persons appeared to be standing, surrounded by an extraordinarily bright light and forming such a sight as you never saw in your life. The central figure was Our Lady, that on her right was Saint Joseph. The third one was identified by Mary Pearson as St. John the Evangelist, because it resembled very much a statue of the saint she had seen in another village, except that now he wore a mitre. A few minutes later, 18 parishioners were assembled before the apparitions. When a diocesan commissioner investigated the phenomenon, 14 witnesses, 3 men, 2 children, 3 teenagers, and 6 women, with ages between 6 and 75, described what they had seen. 3 witnesses reported noticing her bare feet. One woman, Bridget Trench, was so carried away by the sight that she fervently went to the apparitions to embrace the Virgin's feet. But her arms closed on empty air. I felt nothing in the embrace but the wall, yet the figures appeared so full and so lifelike and so lifesisk that I could not understand it and wondered why my hands could not feel that was so plain and distinct to my sight. Bridget also remarked how heavily the rain was then falling, but, she added, I felt the ground carefully with my hands, and it was perfectly dry. The wind was blowing from the south, right against the gable, but no rain fell on that portion of the gable where the figures were. Saint John was standing at an angle to the other figures. Dressed as a bishop, he was holding a large open book in his left hand. The fingers of his right hand were raised in a gesture of teaching. One of the witnesses, Patrick Hill, went close enough to see the lines and letters in the book. When the parish priest was told of the apparitions, he said it might be a reflection from the stained glass windows of the church and quietly spent the rest of the evening at home. The phenomenon lasted several hours. Their clothes soaked through, all the witnesses went home before midnight. The next morning nothing was left to be seen. 10 days after the incident, a deaf child was cured and a man born blind saw after his pilgrimage at Knock. Soon 7 or 8 cures a week were reported. A dying man, so ill that he vomited blood most of the way while being carried to Knock and received the last sacraments from the archdeacon on his arrival, was cured instantaneously after drinking some water in which a scrap of cement from the gable wall had been dissolved. All this came at an unfortunate time for the Catholic Church in Ireland. Most of Archdeacon Kavanagh's fellow priests doubted and disapproved. The Knock Church had been built only 50 years earlier, when Irish Catholics had emerged from hiding, and much as in Leod in the early days, the clergy tried not to get involved in the pilgrimages. Local and national papers were asked by the clergy to refrain from giving the apparition publicity, while some papers hostile to Catholicism printed derisive articles about it. Attempts to explain the phenomenon by physical means were made. A science professor from Maynooth performed tests for the official commission of inquiry appointed by the Archbishop of Tuam. He used a magic lantern to project photographic images on the gable wall in the presence of 20 priests and testified that the tests ruled out the possibility that the apparition had been a product of a photographic hoax. A correspondent of the London Daily Telegraph made his own tests at a later date and reported that however the reported apparitions were caused, they could not have been due to a magic lantern. It is not irreverent to point out that many features in this report are identical to those in UFO phenomena: the strange globe of light of varying intensity, the luminous entities within or close to the light, the absence of rain at the site of the apparition and, finally, the alleged miraculous cures. All these features are present in the current UFO mythology in America. To those who have not closely followed the specialized UFO literature in the last few years, the assertion that UFO sightings involve mysterious cures will come as a surprise. They will find several cases in the appendix, for instance, the Damon, Texas, report of September 3, 1965, where a policeman was allegedly cured of a wound on his hand when exposed to the light from a hovering object, case 694. Or the Petropolis, Brazil, report of October 25, 1957, in which we are told that a girl dying from cancer was saved by a fantastic operation performed by two men who came from the sky, case 415. Clearly we are dealing here with a pattern reminiscent of medieval mysticism. The Knock case is not the most remarkable instance of a similarity between religious apparitions and UFO sightings. And although it took place in Ireland, the miracle aspect is not the UFOs, reminiscent of the standard features of the fairy faith. An incident occurring at daybreak, on Saturday, December 9, 1531, in Mexico, however, does represent the culmination of all the superstitions we have discussed. 5 of tremendous sociological and psychological impact, it has left physical traces that can still be seen, and, indeed, are still an object of much devotion, today. On that long ago morning, a 57-year-old Aztec Indian whose Nahuatl name was Singing Eagle and whose Spanish name was Juan Diego was going to the church of Tlaltcolco, near Mexico City. Suddenly he froze in his tracks as he heard a concert of singing birds, sharp and sweet. The air was bitterly cold, no bird in its right mind would sing at such hour, and yet the harmonious music went on, stopping abruptly. Then someone with a woman's voice called Juan Diego's name. The voice was coming from the top of the hill, which was hidden in a frosty mist, a brightening cloud. And when he climbed the hill, he saw her, The sun wasn't above the horizon, yet Juan saw her as if against the sun because of the golden beams that rayed her person from head to feet. She was a young Mexican girl about 14 years old and wonderfully beautiful. So far, we have a perfect beginning for a standard fairy apparition.